Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. How are you? What's new?
I'm all right. What's new?
Let's limit it to what's new with your reading.
What, globally?
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to go there, I don't think.
Not really, though. Actually, I am going to mention something about Ukraine. But yes, in terms of what we've been reading, I told you about the mushrooms, didn't I, last week?
Yes.
So I won't talk about them again, though they are completely thrilling. I started a sort of science fiction counterfactual, which will make a number of people probably immediately turn off. Please don't turn off. They don't have to read it. It's called A Calculating Stars by
Mary
Robinette.
You read it so we don't have to.
Exactly. Mary Robinette Kowal. I think I'm doing that thing again of reading it about a year late, at least
right.
A year late.
Well, at least we're consistent.
Yeah. About a female sort of mathematician and a counterfactual about what would happen if a massive meteor had struck Washington in 1952. What would happen? I don't know yet. I'm finding out. Hmm. How about you?
Well, I have just today received a book, and it's exactly what was needed. It's a photography book, no words, just photographs by Luigi Ghiri, who was he died quite young. I think he was not even 50, but born in the 40s. Died in the 90s. I don't think I'm wrong in saying one of the most important, 20th century photographers. Italian, obviously, born in Reggio Emilia. And it's this book, it's published by Mac Books. They've been going about 10 years, I think. And it's just a beautiful collection of his photos of Puglia. So, I mean, it's grim and grey here. And it's just this beautiful collection of photos of Puglia. It's called Tra Albe e Tramonti, so between sunrises and sunsets. And he just had this wonderful, I think he started as a surveyor, a land surveyor, and something about the way he must have gone about his day job, looking at the land and noticing minor details, just seems to inform the way that he went about his photography as well. And so many of them have this kind of, when you look at a photograph and you can just see that everything is on the verge of story. There are ready-made characters that just full of context for you to fill in yourself.
Yes, so I've start saying something or
exactly.
Burst into life. So is it in the city or is it in the countryside or both?
They're mostly city. They're lots of warm stone and people leaning against cars and things like that. But yeah, there's more rural scenes as well. But yeah, so I've just lost a few hours. I mean, not lost, gained a few hours.
Yeah.
I've gained a few hours there.
that sounds like a nice way to spend time. I did say that I was going to mention Ukraine. I'm not going to go into the news, as it were, but just to say that we had a piece a couple of weeks ago. So the writer Julian Evans was saying, I think it was when they were Russian troops were sort of on the border.
It was the 18th of February, wasn't it? So it was just before.
Yeah. And I was reading it again, and it's, you know, it's quite prophetic apart from anything else, because he says, were Putin to venture a conventional invasion today, he would find the Ukrainian army ready if outnumbered. He can also be certain of something else. The vast majority of Ukrainians will reject his presence. And he talks about the time that he spent in there. But he's talking about literature from Ukraine. So he's talking about a collection of poetry. And also there were some dispatches from occupied Donbass from someone who was there while that was happening.
That person was put in prison, wasn't he? But 5 years of his 15-year sentence apparently is down to his having put quotation marks around the Donetsk People's Republic, which is remarkable. I suppose it's language, the role of language in all of this.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the tough end of it. There's a book of short stories as well by Yevgenia Belorussets. That's translated as well by Eugene Ostashevsky. And then a report, an account of a sister telling the story of her brother, who was a soldier who died in combat. And I just thought it was worth mentioning, you know, that everything else is still going on there. Literature is still happening there.
Mm.
And these are dispatches. I mean, some of them really actually literally are dispatches from the front line, but the poetry and short stories is a different kind of chronicling, isn't it?
Mm. So this is this piece by Julian Evans. Anyone who is interested will find it on the TLS website. Now, coming up on this week's show, Faint Praise, we'll hear about a recent book on the cultural significance of conking out, from Troilus and Cressida to 50 Shades of Grey via Shakespeare and Bram Stoker, and a new poem, Storm Windows, by Angie Mlinko. But first, Lucy, we're dipping into your arts pages.
Yes, we are, because a couple of weeks ago, an internationally acclaimed and very successful playwright had the world premiere of his new play performed in London, in English, in translation. The play is The Forest, and the playwright, Florian Zeller. He also wrote the plays The Sun, The Height of the Storm, and The Father, which he then directed as a film starring Anthony Hopkins. The film then went on to win an Oscar for Hopkins and one for Zeller, along with his co-writer and long-term translator, Christopher Hampton. We asked Muriel Zaga to review Zeller's new play, and we're delighted that she joins us today to talk us through the most successful representative of contemporary French theatre. Muriel, many thanks for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So first of all, I have to immediately qualify what I've just said. To be fair, you call Zeller the most successful representative of contemporary French theatre. That's along with Yasmina Reza, who wrote Art, among other things. And you talk about the qualities that they share. Can you outline them for us?
I suppose what they have in common is a certain sobriety of language, of dialogue, which perhaps makes translation easier. So it's perhaps no accident that they've both been translated not and performed successfully, not just in English, but in many other languages all over the world as well, because the language lends itself to translation. It's supple enough and sort of limpid enough to be intelligible to many different cultures. And at the same time, they are both recognizably French authors, and that probably is part of their charm.
Are they firmly in a French tradition, do you think?
So, I mean, those things are always very shifting because some people, you know, when you read up about Reza or Zeller in sort of French contexts, people will say they write sort of Anglo-Saxon style theatre.
Right.
Or sometimes they say, in the case of Florian Zeller and Yasmina Reza, that they are representatives of what we call a nouveau boulevard. So, Théâtre du Boulevard, the Boulevard Theatre, is essentially the same as vaudeville, you know. Mm. It's rooted in 19th century sort of bourgeois theatre, comedies of manners, typically stories of adultery. So there's the lover is in the cupboard and, you know, comes back unexpectedly. So usually it's the triangle of husband, wife, lover, or husband, wife, mistress. And there are slamming doors. And so other examples of this are the farces of Georges Feydeau, for example.
That was also notable for being very, very popular, very mainstream, wasn't it?
Enormously mainstream and rather tired. And certainly when I was growing up in a long time ago in the 1970s, boulevard theatre was often on television and it was really middle of the road, quite tired and, you know, exhausted, really. And so what's happened with authors like Florian Zeller and Yasmina Reza before him is a sort of reappropriation of that genre and a rejuvenation of it by adding to it elements of the absurd, elements of the uncanny, making it a little bit more, a little less stable, a bit more sort of slippery, so that you don't quite know what's going on. So that makes, I mean, I don't know, being French myself, I don't know, but I imagine that anything that intellectualizes the theatrical experience will be perceived as typically French. I don't know whether that's true, yes. But, you know, Zeller will say, for example, in interview, he said, because he was originally, he was a novelist, that's how he made his name. Mm. He was a prodigy, in fact, a very young novelist and very successful at a very young age. And then he sort of moved on to the theatre, and the way he describes the change is to say, you know, the theatre is so interesting because it's experiencing something that is ephemeral. It's like training for death.
You know, that's one way of looking at the theatre. We're all training for death all the time, in a way, Florian.
So you're part of something that, you know, as it is being made, is also being unmade. You know, that's a very French way of talking you through the theatrical experience. But where he's brilliant and brilliantly successful is that he makes it very entertaining. So you have your cake and you can also eat it. You know, you think, I'm part of some sort of great cultural moment, significant moment, where I'm connecting with death in some way, you know, and touching my limits. And at the same time, I'm watching a very sort of pacey piece of theatre with a lot of the usual tropes of the husband who's lying to his wife and the girlfriend who's emotionally unstable, and all the doors are slamming more or less metaphorically, and it's not boring. Mm-hmm. But you still come away thinking, feeling that you've performed a cultural act.
Okay. So yes, I see what you mean. Yeah. So that it's actually a difficult line to tread, I imagine.
I think it's incredibly difficult and impressive that it can be achieved. And with Yasmina Reza, the play that really made her name was called Art. And that was the play, this is a long time ago, but it's a three-hander, three male characters. One of them has bought a piece of art, which is essentially a white canvas with thin white lines on it. And he's spent a lot of money on it. And then two of his close friends come and look at it with him, and they discuss the validity of this piece of art, or the significance, possible significance of it. And as a premise, that's quite sort of French, but ultimately it's a comedy, or it's a tragic comedy about manners, about bourgeois manners, about bourgeois anxieties. So that's what I mean. It's walking the line between something that it sort of belongs to, or sort of, you know, dips a toe in through the world of high art and what it might mean, and at the same time gives you an evening of entertainment that is not overcomplicated.
Mm-hmm. It's also notable, isn't it, that just for both of them, that Christopher Hampton, who is a very successful playwright and director himself, is a translator of both of them and Zeller's co-writer on the film of The Father. Do you think that connection has helped, or is that just that he's got a good nose for what works?
Well, probably a bit of both, but I'm sure it's helped tremendously, because his name is a badge of literary quality, but quite deservedly. You know, I remember being astonished by some of his translations of Molière, for example. You know, he's a fantastic, dramatic translator. So yes, I think if you have Hampton as your co-pilot, then probably you're likely to travel much further and more quickly than without. I'm not entirely sure what the dynamic, I don't know, actually. I don't know whether, as an author, you would approach Christopher Hampton and ask him if he'd be interested in translating your plays. And then if he says yes, then that's it. Which is why The Forest was able to be premiered in London in English directly. And I think Zeller had done that before in New York. I think The Mother, which was the play he wrote after The Father, The Mother premiered in New York with Isabelle Huppert in the lead in English.
Oh, in English? Yes. Okay, so it's not the first time he's done it.
No. He's done that before, and that shows a very savvy understanding of what his brand can do, you know.
I didn't know that he was behind the film The Father, actually. And I thought that was brilliantly done.
Yeah, I think what I would say is because I found The Forest slightly disappointing, I wonder if actually he's now not transferred his energies into filmmaking, because he's someone who became famous in his early 20s as a novelist, published a few novels that were well received, partly, dare I say, because he was very, very presentable physically when he was very young.
I was going to mention this because I was looking, no, I wasn't just going to say, gosh, what a dish. What I mean is I was looking, you know, I was looking up and reading about him. And there's a remarkable number of pieces when he's younger.
Yes.
I saw it in Elle and Marie Claire,
exactly,
and Femme Actuelle and all of that. And I was like, how come they're all doing things about this young novelist? And then they were like, and every one of them mentioned his looks.
It makes a nice change, doesn't it? To be that way
around. It was definitely that way around. They were like, look at his cheekbones and his books are all right.
Yeah, so he was a sort of, you know, people described him as a blonde angel. It was that sort of tone, which is, you know, if the genders were reversed, you'd think that's just terribly exploitative. I suppose there's no reason why a man shouldn't be able to ride that wave as well. So he made his name as a novelist, then started writing plays. Slightly by accident, I think he was asked to write a little bit of a libretto for an opera, and then that led to writing plays and, you know, confronting that sort of sense of the ephemeral and so on. And that worked very well for him. And I think the success of The Father was so tremendous. The coup was possibly getting Anthony Hopkins on board, because I think it's probably one of his best performances ever. And then the adaptation, because that is why they won the Oscar for the screenplay, which he adapted, of course, with Christopher Hampton. So that reinforces again his brand as a writer, but also he directed the film himself, which is an unbelievable gift to think that you can be a big fish in a small Parisian bowl where, you know, you're the flavor of the month and everyone thinks you're very clever and very good looking and so on. But then become, as a French author, somebody who is given the reins
to make that jump.
That is really quite extraordinary. And I wonder, because Zeller is very good at promoting himself by slyly evoking influences or parallels with other authors. So, for example, when he was writing novels, he talked about Milan Kundera a lot and said that essentially he was the new iteration. And then with theatre, he talks about Harold Pinter and how this has had just influence on his work. And with film, David Lynch is the person he would evoke. So he is always aiming fairly high in terms of, you know, references and parallels. And there appears to be a sort of order there where he's working his way through different sort of artistic media.
It's a clever work of kind of anchoring, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
To associate yourself with those names.
It is, because there are definitely echoes of all of these people's oeuvres in his own, although some people would say often in a more minor key. But with The Father, it's Lynchian perhaps in the sense that it is that there's this sort of very troubling blurring between reality and dream or imagination illusion. But it's not like a David Lynch movie. The preoccupations are quite different. And dementia is very much referenced currently. You know, there's been a sort of major coming out of to do with Alzheimer's, dementia. We talk about it a lot more openly, and it's in a lot of literature and film. But I think he managed to capture something there that's really affected a lot of people. And the tricks of the film, the visual tricks, have a lot of emotional resonance. So there is substance. So I'm interested to see what his next film adaptation is going to be, because he's now adapting another one of his plays, which is called The Son. So there was The Father, then The Mother, then The Son, which is about a couple whose son is in deep depression and they're trying to help him out and not really very able to do it. And that, I think, he's managed to net Laura Dern and Hugh Jackman for the leads. So it's very likely to be, you know, to have a lot of money behind it, and we'll have to see if it's as good as the father, but certainly the sons are very promising. And it may be then, therefore, that his interest in the theatre is waning slightly. Perhaps it's difficult to do both.
Yes, it must be. Yeah. I wonder if I was thinking about the father, which I only know, I've only seen kind of bits of it, but I've read about it. I wondered if, because he does seem to have a sort of style, doesn't he? Like recurring lines and sort of acts. We'll go back to this in more detail for the forest, but and sort of Pinteresque in a way, and what you say about the decor and of the set changing and sort of visual tricks. Do you think that worked brilliantly for Dementia? Because in a way, it's almost a little bit like a recreation of what it might feel like, but then it doesn't work so well for other things.
Yes, I think there was a sort of a synergy there, or a very happy encounter between for those of us who have not experienced it yet, but from what we know of how dementia affects people, the sort of onset of confusion and not losing your bearings, you know, not really knowing where you are, people change their appearance and you forget who they are, all of that, to be able to make that tangible with through a sort of, you know, again, the sort of Pinteresque absurdist approach, it gives it substance, it gives it meaning. So it's not just a jeu d'esprit where this might mean one thing or it might mean another. And that is slightly the issue with the forest, is that there's not that much at stake, whereas in the father, the story is very strong. There is a lot at stake. And it's very French, again, to talk about the human condition, you know, and tackling the human condition. But I think he does actually achieve that with the father. He does put his finger on something that everyone can relate to in themselves and in possibly a family member, but also in themselves, because we're all of us every day at times wrestling with, you know, a clarity. It's not always. Maybe I'm speaking for myself.
Oh, no. I said, in fact, I was saying to a family member this morning that I was having trouble with nouns. They looked at me a bit blankly. Everything okay? Anyway, let's say that nouns are fine for now. Let's talk about The Forest then, the new play. So it's directed by another long-term collaborator, Jonathan Kent, and it's at the Hampstead Theatre. What was it like?
So it's gorgeous. It's wonderfully staged. There's a very clever sort of fragmented stage, which again is a sort of metaphor for the mind of the protagonist, who's confused about the possible consequences of an adulterous affair that he's had. So part of the set is his apartment where he lives with his wife, and then part of the set is the bedroom where he meets his girlfriend, and another part of the set is a sort of strange study or interrogation room or office where other things happen. That's all very well done. The cast is great. I did think it was rather a slight piece compared to previous plays of Zeller's, because the boulevard element, so the vaudeville element of the husband, wife, mistress, is pretty much still left intact. There's a little bit of a nightmarish twist. We don't know. I mean, the character of the man, of the husband, is played by two actors, Paul McGann and Toby Stevens, who play sort of alternating versions of the same person. So you have to hang on to your hat and try and work out what happened, what really happened. You know, is the girlfriend still alive or not? Who said what? Scenes are repeated, again, in a sort of Pinteresque or absurdist way. Scenes are repeated with tiny variations, which is something that Yasmina Reza also has experimented with, to make you question what really happened. And all of that is quite entertaining, but ultimately it's about a very vain man who's had an affair with a younger woman and is feeling terrible about it. And that it's difficult to engage emotionally beyond a certain point with that story. I didn't think there was enough there to warrant, the stamp of a really interesting, innovative play. It seemed a little tired. Also, the female parts are thin, incredibly thin. And I, of course, everything is seen through the point of view of the man. So perhaps that is how he sees them. You know, we have to allow for that. But the wife is played by Gina McKee, who's a wonderful actress and is really not given very much to do here. The girlfriend is played by Angel Corby, who, again, has a lot of energy, but is reduced to the part of unstable, hot chick, essentially, and the wife is a long-suffering but very beautiful wife.
That sounds like a cliché, doesn't it? I mean,
it sounds very French, I would say, even. That it's, you know, not for the first time have I thought, we, the French, I have to take some of the responsibility, have not received, there are quite a few memos that got lost, you know, we still haven't received. So I don't think Florian Zeller, for example, is aware that this sort of these sorts of tropes about women are difficult to sell nowadays. I don't think he knows that, and he's not he's quite a young man, so that's just food for thought in terms of how quickly French society is changing or not.
Yes,
I suppose in a sense then it's sort of surprising that one of the what sounds like one of the most on the nose lines in the play is uttered by, I think it's the daughter, you say. She says, in the end, it's always the same story. And that seems to almost be the line that summarizes your thoughts on the play. There's a tiredness you've mentioned. It's almost like maybe he's exhausted the style that he's been working in up to this point. Does he just need to try something new?
I think so. I think maybe it's time to move away from boulevard, nouveau boulevard, old boulevard, get off the boulevard. And trying something entirely different. Yeah, I think he's possibly reached the limit of that. And maybe it's a question of age as well, that he's now, how old is he now? Actually, he's in his 40s now, isn't he?
I think so, yeah.
Not quite. So perhaps it's no accident that where he's done really well is with the father, with a story that is about graver themes and a little less about male vanity, a little more about human frailty.
Would you say that he does have a style and that this is possibly the thing that you think maybe he needs to change a bit now? There's this thing about recurring lines. Theo say she says that. Also, I think I was reading a review we had of The Height of the Storm, which also has the line, it's always the same story in it. And in The Forest, you say, someone says, you've changed our lives. And then later on, he says to someone else, you've changed my life many times. There are recurring phrases, aren't there? And bouquets of flowers in The Height of the Storm as well. Apparently, bouquets of flowers turn up. Nobody knows what the heck is going on. Do you think he's sort of recycling things a bit?
I think he is. I mean, in a way, you could say, well, he's creating his dramatic universe. So maybe that is one. Also, often characters have the same. I mean, some of the same names recur. You know, wives are often called Laurence, for example. André is a name that, I mean, you know, various names. And you could say, well, that's because he's just sort of refining his universe. I agree that there's an element of formula, possibly. And that he, well, you know, he is very self-aware. And so he would say, for example, that his early novels, which were celebrated, I mean, up to a point, you know, within, again, a smallish Parisian bull, perhaps, that they were works of his youth and that he feels no connection to them now. And that perhaps if you are an artist who's going to keep going forward, then you have to be prepared to cast aside various skins, you know, and so the novelist skin is gone. It is possible, I think, that he's reached the end of the line. I say that, and then he's going to come back and dazzle us all with a play next year, and then I'll be delighted. But perhaps it's time to let go of that, the dramatist skin, and instead devote himself to films, because he appears to have a real talent for filmmaking.
You said in your piece as well that the theatre of the absurd, it's almost pastiched in The Forest. I'm not necessarily supposed to be funny. It reminded me, because I saw the Ionesco, The Chairs, which is on at the moment as well, just about to finish, I think, which was kind of extreme theatre of the absurd, and it was absolutely wonderful. But a crucial difference seemed to me was that Ionesco absolutely does not take itself seriously, or certainly not too seriously.
I think one of the problems is lack of humour. Yes, and is a certain po-faced approach to his own writing, in the case of Zeller, perhaps because perhaps because he's been taken so seriously from the beginning, and also because he's not really invented this way of telling stories. You know, as I said, I mentioned that in relation to Pinter, Harold Pinter, Eugene Ionesco invented a certain kind of theatre. And Zeller is an heir to them, but he's not a creator. And so possibly there's a certain reverence in the way that he uses those tropes, because they are, you know, sacred things that he has inherited from other people, rather than a playful experimentation of his own.
Mm. And actually both of those writers, Pinter and Ionesco, you'd have thought wouldn't have 10 seconds of time for reverence.
No.
Would they? I mean... Absolutely not their style at all.
No, exactly. Yeah. So it's perhaps no accident that Florian Zeller likes to write about the divided consciousness, because perhaps that's how he feels in the creative act. I don't know. But I would say, yes, this play, and we can't say, oh, it's because of the translation. The translation is very good. And I'm sure that it wouldn't be that different in French. And the translation retains some of the French flavor, because the sexual politics are so French, as I was saying. So if you want a little bit of a taste of French theater, then it's a sort of a harmless way to spend the evening. But I don't imagine he has many more plays in him of that ilk, because really it's, I think, as Gide, André Gide, wrote something about theater and morality along the lines of, I'm paraphrasing, but the ages that have produced theater that is otherworldly, incredibly sort of noble, you know, so Greek tragedy or the tragedies of Racine, for example, those were the great ages where public morality, social morality was at its highest, he says. Whereas bourgeois theatre of the kind that Zeller and Yasmin Ereza produce, which is a sort of mirror image of the theatre audience. People go and watch their plays partly to watch themselves on stage, because they're the ones being lampooned. And it's fun to see yourself being lampooned and then to think, well, I'm not as bad as him, or I'm not as extreme as this, you know, a ridiculous person, and then walk away feeling a little bit better. Then that, Gide would say, that's a very, very thin way of engaging with the theatre, and it doesn't reflect well on our own morals as a society.
Oh, you mean that we should be kind of undergoing catharsis, that sort of thing?
We should be undergoing catharsis, Lucy. Mm.
That's what we should be doing. Well, and actually catharsis, it doesn't have to be tragic either, does it? I mean, it's usually used in the tragic sense, but it could be, it's a sort of extreme, isn't it, in any sense?
It is. I mean, a paroxysm of laughter is just as cleansing as the tears of tragedy. Yes, I did think the play, that's another issue I had with The Forest, is it's not that funny. There's a little bit of comedy, but it comes through from performance. Toby Stevens is very amusing and sort of runs with the part and chews at the furniture and is very, there are moments of high comedy, but not really sufficient. Because the tone keeps changing. So is it real? Is it a dream? Is it tragedy? Is it comedy? So one, you begin to enjoy yourself and it sort of takes off, and then we have to go back to a sort of simulacrum of theatre of the absurd. There's a character called Man in Black who wears white makeup that looks like a mask, and he appears at times, you know, and reappears as a sort of judge from another world. And I'm not entirely sure that it's the tone was quite right, because I think it was funny without meaning to be at times.
Yes, that's probably not what you want, is it, really? Yeah, unintentionally funny.
Do these plays, after they've premiered in England and in America on Broadway, do they tend to transfer to France, or do they not have a run in France? I'm just wondering if it's like he's struck just the right amount of packaged Frenchness for you know, us Brits and Americans to identify as a French play by a French playwright, but that Frenchness just doesn't really play so well in France anymore. They're a bit tired of that Frenchness.
I think it's a very good question. I mean, as far as I know, The Mother, La Mère, was performed in France afterwards. And he, because of his notoriety, he has access to top performers. So very famous, prestigious actors will gladly work with him. So they usually do very well in France as well. I imagine The Forest will transfer also. But there is something profound in what, I mean, I'm sure what you're saying is true, that he's hit upon a kind of dream formula of just enough Frenchness for Le Monde Anglo-Saxon and other worlds, and that possibly that is where he will fare best, is outside of France. But there's still certainly an appetite in France for the, where he will then probably be perceived as a sort of Anglo-Saxon product, because coming back from New York or coming back from London. So it cuts both ways. It works on all levels.
There's the brilliant line you've got in your piece when you say French enough, but not too French, intellectual, but not too intellectual, challenging, but not too challenging. That's just about The Forest. That's not about all of his work, is it?
Well,
or is it? Or do we just watch The Father and then wait for the next one?
No, well, I think The Father is a very successful adaptation, because it's no longer a French story, is it? So that's very good. I do think that there's something a little sort of existentialist light, or philosophical light about the output. But that's why it works, because it's also trying to be entertainment. And so perhaps we can't be too stern about that. You know, you're trying to give people a good evening out at the theatre, and at the same time, you're trying to do something that holds together as a sort of an artistic proposition. So you can't be too French, because then it wouldn't translate so well. You can't be too challenging, because a lot of people would leave in the interval. You want people to stay. It's a difficult balance, and not many people have succeeded at it. So he's obviously hit on a balance that works.
Yes, he is. He's obviously doing something right, what with his international success and acclaim. So I think, yeah, we wait and see what the film of The Mother is like. Muriel, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on the show, Storm Windows, a new poem by Angie Mlinko. And what does it mean, in a narrative sense, when a character passes out? And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Now, before we turn to the meaning and implications of fainting in literature, there is time to hear a new poem by Angie Malenko, The Deeply Atmospheric Storm Windows, first published in this week's TLS. Angie joins us now to read it for us. Angie, hello, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Does this poem come from your new collection, Venice, or does it stand alone like the lighthouse at its heart?
No, this is part of a whole network of poems about Florida and also Europe, Italy. There's a Venice in Florida as well as Italy. I sort of toggle between the two.
Well, without further ado, then let's hear Storm Windows, please.
Storm Windows. The first was a fair youth clutching a loaded brown Bess. In his pockets, iron hanks and hooks furred green with watercress. Then a lady in a farthingale. Some strolled out of the surf, some tumbled to the shore at a king tide's royal rebuff. Each time a squall passed through, a window opened. In furbelows and jewels they came, in drenched velvet doublets and hose. They had danced the tarantella, the gigue, the allemande, but found that a bell on the seafloor can't make a sound. I knew about the shipwrecks. I shuffled up the lacy spiral of the lighthouse steps. Its shadow, like a sundial, fell on the migrant dunes, telling us where we stood. The hour of the Anthropocene, I put up my hood against the wind. The light warmed the iron rails, traced the smile of the horizon filled with toothy sails. Beneath the breakers was a strong box, a tankard, a hogshead of oil, a butt of beer, cider, wine, ordnance, lard for the lamps, at least one encrusted Queen Anne pistol, belt buckles, buttons, coins. They grew a sea gristle. But I saw no ghosts, felt no tug at my hem, and the whispers of those strange words, like sextant, like vespers, were dredged from my throat as terms whereunder I could fathom my share in the life they surrender. Now twirling the rod, Wittershins, to make the slats lift on the blind ruling the landscape, I write, I must, where but in their settled dust.
Angie Malenko, thank you very much for that. Venice, a new collection of poems, will be published next month. Now, it might seem implausible that the act of passing out would leave much of an impression on English literature, writes the critic Catherine Hughes this week. When a character in a novel or play swoons, faints, or ends up otherwise unconscious, they are, in effect, going absent without leave. All the reader can do is wait until they come round and start making sense again. But Naomi Booth, a writer and academic whose website lists her interests as including weird landscapes, concentric objects, pregnancy, skin, crocuses, and environmental contamination, sees a subtext to mine. In her book, Swoon, A Poetics of Passing Out, Booth argues that characters silenced by a loss of consciousness are in fact speaking volumes. What about? Well, Catherine Hughes is here to help us figure that out. Catherine, hello, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, delighted to be here.
Can you sort of set out the premise of this book in a little more detail, please?
Yes, I mean, what Naomi Booth does is starts off with the idea that I think we all have, or I certainly did, which is that when a character's out for the count, unconscious, nothing much can happen. It's like a full stop in the narrative. We just have to wait until they come round again and the story carries on. Of course, what Naomi Booth says very cleverly and drawing her examples right from medieval literature right through to the most contemporary novels is that actually that swoon, that moment of non-being is actually hugely eloquent and loquacious. It's doing all sorts of not just narrative work, but personality work. I mean, in other words, you know, people basically pass out for a whole load of reasons. Can be anything from fear to lust to panic, and it can even be a bit contrived. It can just be because you want to get out of a tricky conversation. So what she does is make us look again at those moments where nothing seems to happen, and she shows us that, you know, to the contrary, all sorts of things are happening. We just need to learn to pay attention.
And that crucially, it's not a stable thing. If a character in something from the in something from the 17th century swoons, it doesn't have the same meaning as if a character in the 19th century novel swoons.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's particularly interesting, I think, around gender, because I certainly tended to think, well, it's fainting is just sort of, it's sort of ladies, isn't it, in the 18th and 19th century? It's probably all to do with wanting to express sensibility. And while that's true, it's certainly not true if you go back to the Middle Ages, to Chaucer, for instance, where she has a very good example, Troilus and Cressida, where Troilus, who is this young, heroic Trojan hero, passes out in a really extraordinary way. I mean, his heart stops, his eyes swivel backwards in his head, and he's really out for the count. And this is because he's actually madly in love with Crusade. Now, that just goes completely against anything that we're used to thinking about. You know, you'd expect Crusade to be the one who was had an attack of the vapors, but not at all. And I think Booth says something quite interesting. She says that when we don't take account of the historical context, we get ourselves into really terrible pickles. So, for instance, there's been a lot of very, very clumsy contemporary criticism around Troilus passing out just when he's about to consummate his relationship with Crusade. Analytic therapists have been rushing in there to say, well, actually what Troilus is worried about is premature ejaculation or impotence, or, you know. And actually, no, if you attend to the things that Chaucer says about fainting and you attend to the whole romance tradition of the late medieval period, you realise that actually Chaucer's actually just telling us something about Troilus's incredible strength of feeling, his passion, his power. It's actually a very virile thing to do. Mm. It's not girly. He's not avoiding anything. And I think that's where Booth is so good. You know, she makes us think again. She makes us feel a bit daft about our resolutely kind of contemporary mindset when we're reading medieval texts.
So Troilus is passing out, which is an example of what a kind of courtly lover he is, because all the things about, you know, I burn and then I'm icy, and then, you know, there's sometimes you read it in the literature, they say I swoon. But I mean, you don't really think that's going to happen. But Troilus is just kind of embodying this tradition, is he?
Absolutely. He is showing us what, in the courtly tradition, what a proper man does. And what a proper man does is swoon. And what's so interesting about Chaucer's description is that he actually has an angle on the physiological symptoms. So Troilus literally, as I said before, his eyes are sort of turning backwards in his head, which must have been very, very scary for Crusade. He feels as though his heart is stopping pumping. It's a very precise physiological description, and it's there to make us see what an extraordinary hero he is.
And in terms of the power of feeling and the fact that Troilus swoons precisely because he is so so manly and full of passion, there's a strange sort of sympathy in a religious tradition in the 16th century, isn't there? You mentioned Teresa of Avila.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, Booth has really interesting things to say about Saint Teresa. She actually is barely upright, if you believe her. She seems to be swooning constantly. She refers to these, Saint Teresa does, as rapture. She's constantly in raptures. And she sees this passing out, this being elsewhere, as taking her closer to God. So she's literally sort of loosening her earthly ties. What makes it all more complicated is that Teresa also believed that she levitated at the same time as swooning, and so did her sister nuns. And she would have to instruct them, please hold me down, sisters. So it conjures up this extraordinary mental picture of St. Teresa floating up into the air and slightly panicked, and nuns kind of holding her down off four corners like a tent in the wind. But again, Teresa is saying something about the extraordinary power of her mental absences, that she is literally, it's an altered state. It's not an absence, it's a kind of going into a new and more intense place.
That's actually true of fainting anyway, isn't it, really? I mean, I don't know about... hasn't happened to me very often, but it's not like being asleep. There is a kind of moment at which it feels very different to either being awake or being asleep. You can easily see that that's a religious experience.
Yeah, absolutely. It hasn't happened to me very much, but I agree. It has a different quality. I have to say that whenever I fainted, I haven't also levitated.
Maybe they just didn't tell you.
Maybe I was floating 6 feet above and I didn't realise. But yeah, absolutely. Fainting, you're absolutely right, Lucy. It's not just I feel sleepy. It's something happens to one's vision. In my experience, it sort of goes dark around the edges and you get a sort of almost like pinhole type vision. It's very, very strange.
And you know it's coming on and it slowly builds.
But you can't stop it. I mean, that's the very strange thing about it. It is as if you've handed over your body to another power, which I suppose is what Teresa was trying to gesture towards in her slightly kind of heightened language.
It seems to me as well that if she's talking about it, that she's communicating with God at those points, she feels like she's communicating with God. That's a very active thing to do. She's not checking out.
She's checking in.
Exactly. Yeah,
absolutely. She calls again. It's slightly odd. And again, we probably read the language slightly strangely, but I mean, she talks about her embarrassment of raptures and, you know, there's a sense of which she is embarrassed, but there's also, I don't know, again, whether I'm bringing my own stuff to it, but there's a slight self-congratulatory quality. Look, you know, I'm so good at doing this rapture stuff. It's an embarrassment. I'm sorry, sisters. I know it's a bore. You've all got to kind of stop what you're doing and come and hold me down.
Pin me down.
Pin me down. So I don't, you know, I and again, that I may be being crass, but I think there is a sense in which she's, there's a sort of social awkwardness that then translates into a feeling slightly pleased with yourself because you've somehow been magicked onto a higher plane.
Yeah, you have this strength, this superpower that others don't. So at what point then did our literature start to resemble something closer to what we talked about, our assumptions earlier, that, you know, gendered swooning along the lines that we would expect, a sign of feminine weakness or hysteria or, you know, oversensitivity?
I think what Booth says is by the time we get to Shakespeare, it's a landscape that we understand. In other words, it's the girls who faint. And if men are knocked unconscious, it is, you know, during battle. It's because they've lost a lot of blood and are very brave. Whereas the girls faint because they are embarrassed, appalled, frightened, all those kinds of things. And she's particularly interested in Much Ado About Nothing, where the heroine, who's confusingly called Hero, passes out again just at the moment she is to be married. So again, at that peak moment of sort of consummation. But in this case, it's because her groom, Claudio, has been misinformed that she's actually been unchaste. So this news has suddenly come. Actually, Hero is not a maid, not a virgin. She shouldn't be getting married. And Hero is so appalled at that thought that she completely faints away. And in a sense, that I think we understand, because what she's passing out from is not just shock, but also shame, a very proper female shame. What's so extraordinary, what happens next, though, is that while she's out for the count and the bridegroom and his party leave in high dudgeon because they're very cross at possibly having, you know, had a sort of unchaste bride forced upon him, then the bridal party sort of clusters around Hero and starts to interpret her body. So her father talks about her foul, tainted flesh, which I think is a bit rude.
Which is nice.
Thank you, Dad. nice to feel you on my side. Her cousin, who is also the bridesmaid, says, no, she hasn't lied. She's belied. So she literally, she's lying down, but also people have told lies about her. And then the friar, who really stands in as the vicar, the man who's doing the ceremony, launches into this extraordinary account of her body. He leans over her recumbent body and says, you know, I've seen her blush when she's awake. This is absolutely a maiden of impeccable morals. She's so chaste. Her body is entirely the sort of body that you would want. It's a body that colours up at the thought of anything unpleasant or, you know, untoward. Therefore, I know that she is chaste. And there's something quite creepy about it. I mean, there's three people standing around Hero's completely recumbent body, commenting on her in the most kind of peculiar and unattractive way. But there is a sense in which she has the power. I mean, she is the focus of attention. There is no other conversation in town except this question of what her body is doing, what her body has said, what it means when it behaves in certain ways. So again, I think you get this sense of, yeah, swooning is a sign of female weakness, passivity, but also it's got this kind of strange undertow of strength in which it forces all eyes upon itself. And all conversations are about it. So I think Shakespeare does something quite clever there.
Yeah, and then certainly when you think of 18th century literature, swooning by that point is pretty well established as a feminine thing. If you think of Clarissa, Richardson's heroine is just constantly fainting, and it's like every faint foreshadows and cements her decline, her kind of her growing weakness and vulnerability.
Absolutely, but it's also a sign, isn't it, of implicitly of her virtue as well. I mean, it's when things are getting too hot, she absents herself. What I think is so interesting in Persuasion, Jane Austen's last novel, I don't know if you remember the Musgrave sisters, who are two silly girls who quite like the idea of passing out as a
knowingly faint, don't they?
And contrive things. One of them jumps down from the cob at Lyme Regis, and actually stupidly it all goes wrong and her bow doesn't manage to catch her in time. She actually does do quite a bit of damage to herself. But Austen is so satirizing that 18th century heightened sensibility idea of, fainting to show that you are just such a little China doll, such a lovely girly girl that you need a masculine protector. And, you know, it's the sort of thing that she has absolutely no truck with at all.
You've alluded to the kind of the pornographic undercurrent, sometimes less under and more over, but where this really, really comes out in Booth's study is in the case of Bram Stoker's Dracula. I mean, what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, the way that Booth reads Dracula, it is quite honestly like a sort of 70s porno movie. Again, very few people are upright for more than about 2 seconds. Everybody is swooning, usually as a prelude to then being predated upon by a vampire, if not Count Dracula himself. So that fainting clearly becomes a sort of stand-in for giving way sexually. And it happens now as much to men as women. So there's a very interesting passage with Jonathan Harker, the sort of erstwhile hero. He is constantly on the point of swooning. First of all, once he goes out to the castle, he's accosted by three rather sexy, overbearing women with ruby lips and sharp teeth. And instead of running a mile, he just says he feels completely sort of impassioned. He just wants to kiss them. He wants them to kiss him. And at that point, he sort of virtually faints clean away. At that point, Count Dracula comes in to rescue Harker, who's really playing the role now of, you know, maiden in distress. And what does Dracula do? But he picks up the swooning body of Jonathan Harker and takes him off to his bedroom. So, I mean, Booth is very interested in the way that queer sexuality can get played out and through the swoon. So she very much sees Harker's swoon here and being gathered up by Dracula and taken off to his bedroom as a very interesting way of kind of introducing a whole set of alliances and allegiances which, you know, aren't there on the surface of the text. But at the same time, we also have good old-fashioned patriarchal pornography with these three overbearing women with, you know, enormous lips and teeth who are going to bear down on Harker and have their way with him. So that swooning just becomes the kind of act that allows the merging of all kinds of bodies in all kinds of possible combinations. There really are no boundaries between people. And that's what I mean when I say that, you know, reading it again or reading it through Booth's analysis, you do get a sense of a sort of swingers party in the sense that it's a kind of barely choreographed dance of lust and desire in which anybody can have anybody because there's really no firm, impermeable boundary between each body.
And between the living and the dead.
And between men and women.
And between men and women, and well, between everything and everything, really. But I mean, from there, Booth, she wants to bring her study up to date. So she turns to 50 Shades of Grey. And for someone who, as you describe her, has a very strong interest in queer sexualities and coming from something as subversive as Dracula, to then find herself talking about 50 Shades of Grey must have been quite frustrating for her as well. I mean, the swooning here is pretty disappointing and grim, you know, very far from anything subversive or even Troilus-like. It's the powerless.
I think she finds it, Booth at the end becomes quite schoolmistressy about swooning, and various people have got, you know, high marks for good interpretive swooning, everybody from Troilus to Hero to Jonathan Harker. But she will not give high marks to 50 Shades of Grey because she sees it as a very thin kind of discourse. There's nothing to be read into it apart from what it is. And what happens is that Anastasia Steele, the heroine, again, is barely upright. She seems constantly, when the hero looms into view, to be on the floor. At one point she's even being sick, which I can't imagine is meant to be erotic, but possibly is. She can never, as it were, inhabit her own body. She can't act upon her desires, but nor can she even do something interesting with her fainting. I think that's the point. She is squeezed into a corner where her fainting is of the most kind of childish play acting, pointless kind of way. I mean, she literally also wears high heels apparently all the way through. I haven't got very far with 50 Shades of Grey, and she's constantly she's constantly toppling off her high heels and spraining her ankles.
She should just wear Dr. Martens, and then, you know,
I know. But that's really interesting, I think, because that is a kind of contrived swooning. You know, she's making herself fall by these very perverse choices she makes that she really doesn't have to. And so Booth ends really on quite a cross note, having written very lushly and lovingly about all these other examples of the swoon and made you feel that it's a subject of sort of infinite richness. You know, just it makes you think about text in a completely different way. Even Dickens has some interesting swoons. I mean, Mrs. Gamp is, Sary Gamp is constantly swooning. And in that case, it's because she just wants to draw attention to herself. So it even enriches those kind of quite comic texts that Dickens writes. Mm-hmm. But something goes wrong with 50 Shades. Sorry, I've demoted it to 20 Shades.
20 is quite enough as far as I'm concerned.
It uses all the kind of sort of tropes, I suppose we would say, today, of vampire fiction. Indeed, it started as a kind of Twilight fan fiction. So it knows what it's doing, but what it's doing is really not very interesting.
Well, I wonder then what swoony scenes from literature we should all go back and reread, how our impressions of books that we think we know so well might change as a result of this. Is there anything that you, Catherine, that you think, like, oh, I had never noticed, I'd never thought about it that way before?
Well, I was really interested in Dickens, Mrs. Gamp, Sary Gamp, this sort of comic, obnoxious figure who uses fainting or the threat of fainting as a kind of social currency. I hadn't quite noticed that before. Also in Dickens, I mean, when Lady Dedlock swoons, and it's because of the emotion of realising that Esther Summerson is actually her daughter.
Oh, spoiler, you know. Spoiler. Well,
everybody knows that. The swoon for Lady Dedlock, who has been so in charge, so self-contained, so impermeable to the outside world, isn't she? I mean, she's just bored. She's just, nothing can get to her. The weather, nothing. Celesta, nothing. She's entirely a sort of homeostatic being of her own making. When she swoons, it is the moment of a sort of narrative breach where she kind of enters the plot, the emotional plot of the book. She becomes actually a real person, a real woman, a mother who has had to give up her child. I thought I slightly dismissed before as this is just Victorian melodrama, but thinking more carefully now about what sort of characters swoon and what happens when the swoon is out of character, not the person that you expect.
It's a sort of different kind of rupture to the ruptures that we were talking about with St. Teresa. Yeah. Well, I feel a listener challenge coming on to you, Lucy.
Favourite literary swoons?
Yeah. Why not?
Absolutely. Do tell us all about them.
Catherine Hughes, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Angie Mlinko, Catherine Hughes and Muriel Zaga. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.